So next up we have Ms. Evelyn Liebman, and she is currently a student at Boston University School of Public Health and is pursuing her MPH degree with a concentration in health law, bioethics, and human rights. Yay. So you must be working with Dr. Grodin then on a research project that's focusing on historical medical ethics regarding the Holocaust with a special interest in the role of Jewish physicians, dentists, and nurses, and she'll be speaking on the role of Jewish physicians and allied health professionals in the ghettos and camps during the Holocaust. Ms. Liebman.
Thank you all so much for having me here. It's a real pleasure to be here, and thanks so much to the Ethics Fig for having me. So I've been doing this research for about 2 years now with Dr. Michael Grodin at BU School of Public Health in the Health Law, Bioethics, and Human Rights Department, and I have nothing to disclose. A few people I wanted to thank who have helped us along the way, particularly Rochelle Rubin and Nadia, and they've been really great, especially BU School of Public Health. They've been very supportive of our research and have done a lot to help us publicize what we've done. So the Holocaust is a really difficult topic, and the reason that we started doing this topic in the first place was because there has been a lot of research about Nazis and Nazi research that has gone on, particularly twin studies. In recent years, there's been a lot of books published on it, but we didn't know that much about Jewish physicians and nurses and other allied health professionals, and we wanted to learn more about what they did because we knew that medicine didn't just stop and public health didn't just stop when the Holocaust began, and we wanted to understand how it changed and how it evolved and how these people dealt with immensely difficult ethical dilemmas. So a little background on the Holocaust. There were approximately 11 million victims of the Holocaust. Approximately 6 million were Jewish, but it really encompassed a large number of people, prisoners of war, disabled individuals, gypsies, and I think it's important to understand that this genocide didn't just impact one group of people. It really impacted a large number of groups of people and anybody who was perceived to be within these groups of people, and I think that's really important to understand. There were several different phases, including ghettoization, concentration camps, and finally extermination camps. And public health and medicine really evolved throughout each and every stage of the Holocaust. And we're going to be able to look at a few different stories today because I think that's the best way to understand this research and the best way to understand this topic. And the focus on eugenics was important, and I think that it's important to understand that up front because so much of the public health and the medicine and what people did focused around the idea of eugenics and how do you combat it, and sometimes how do you deal with eugenics, particularly for doctors who dealt with euthanasia. It was a really difficult topic within the camps and within the ghettos. It's also important to look at pictures, I think. It's, at least for me, when I was beginning this research, it was so difficult to understand a topic that I couldn't envision, that I just had no idea of what this atrocity and what this devastation looked like. So this is a picture of what a barracks looked like, where prisoners were housed. And I think it's important to look at the lack of shelter, the lack of food, the lack of clothing, and how all of this contributed to the public health dilemma of what do you do in this situation when you don't have resources. So there could be infinite slides on what the ethical dilemmas were, so I've tried to pick out a few really pertinent ones. The sanctity of life versus the quality of life was really important, particularly when you're understanding euthanasia. Do we try and keep people going with the limited resources that we have, or do we provide a comfortable death? This is a really interesting, really difficult question that people grappled with. Performing abortions, particularly within Auschwitz, that was a very difficult question when pregnancy was prohibited, and that could mean death for the mom, certainly for the baby, and for anybody who was involved in helping hide these pregnancies. That was a really important ethical dilemma that did occur. And comforting patients, and I think a big topic that comes up is how do you be a healthcare provider when you don't have resources, when you don't have medication, when you don't have food, when you don't have water, and is it still possible to be a healthcare provider in that situation? And so I think that this particular topic and this historical framework gets at that difficult topic. Other starvation, certainly. Hunger disease was extremely pervasive and something that doctors had to find ways to either study in some cases, and in other cases, do they take food from the people who have already died? Does that violate sanctity of life? And these were situations that people didn't think they would ever have to encounter. And when they did, we tried to pick out certain pieces of information that would help us understand their thought processes. So the way that we conducted this research was by gathering all the information that we could find in memoirs, particularly written in English. We wanted to understand the tales of these doctors, and oftentimes they are written by their children, to understand their thought processes and what they went through in these camps when they were trying to figure out what to do with these little resources. So I wanted to start with the Warsaw Ghetto. So the Warsaw Ghetto was the largest of the ghettos that were established. It had over 400,000 Jews in a small area. 1.3 square miles is a very small area to house that many individuals, which you can imagine the public health dilemmas that stemmed from that. So the responsibilities of the physicians and other health professionals in this ghetto were to establish health policies and protocols while serving as members of the Judenrat. So a Judenrat was a council of Jewish, generally physicians, that were brought together to sort of run the ghetto, to figure out the public health protocols, to allocate food, to allocate medicine, to figure out what to do with the orphan population and sanitation. They really were in charge very much like a mayor of a ghetto, and sometimes they were forced by Nazis to be created, and other times physicians gathered together in order to help fill this role that was certainly needed within the ghettos. And it's important that they organized and they provided medical services. Medical services didn't just stop within the ghettos. So how they pulled their physicians together, how they pulled resources, were extremely important. So one of the more interesting pieces that we found when we were doing the Warsaw Ghetto was this book called Hunger Disease. So a number of physicians decided that they wanted to do something productive and that there was probably what they'd hoped was there'd never be another situation where such mass starvation and hunger disease was occurring. So they wanted to get together to study this and to understand the physiology of what happens to a person when they don't have enough food or water. So they had really expected to die, and they wanted to leave something for future generations to understand what hunger and starvation does to a human body. And when you're reading these stories, it's fascinating because it completely accounts for the ethical dimensions of what you do with research. There's a huge debate when you read the literature about this study that was being conducted of, do you include children? Is the research going to be so damaging to patients who are in the ghetto already that they shouldn't conduct it at all? And I was blown away by the fact that they had these ethical considerations considering they're in a ghetto. They are currently being starved to death. And that was fascinating to me. And at least the silver lining from this whole project for me was that there are people who are still willing to make ethical decisions, who still engage in these thought processes no matter what situations they were in. And I think that's a really important thing to know about humanity. So also, medical and nursing education continued within the ghettos. They had underground schools in order to keep providing more physicians and nurses that the hospitals desperately needed. And when they didn't have resources, what they tried to do was provide a human resource, because it's important to have people who are there who can comfort patients, who can sit with them, who can provide them compassion when they otherwise don't have anything. They didn't have food, they didn't have medications, and that was important. And the people who engaged in this were taking major risks. It was risky to be a professional and to be a teacher in these schools, and it was risky to work in the hospitals. It was extremely well known in a ghetto that was close by that the hospital was burnt down with all the patients within it and any doctors and nurses that were locked within the hospital. So it was very risky undertaking at the time to be a health professional. And I think this picture is really illustrative of what the nurses did, which was being with the patients, being a comforting person when they were dying and when they didn't have anything else. And that was important. And if nothing else, that's what the role of a healthcare provider was in this situation. Dr. Adina Brady-Zweiger, sorry if I butcher that name, she was fascinating. She was a pediatrician. She herself contracted typhus while she was working with the children. One of the ways that she found to help them was by creating a playroom, by thinking really out of the box in terms of what she could provide for them as a physician. And that was so much to these children, many of whom didn't have parents, many of whom their parents were either shipped to extermination camps or to labor camps. And how do you comfort these children when you don't have medication and when you don't really have anything for them? So she also injected children with morphine to euthanize them when there were sweeps in the hospital and anybody who was sick was taken and exterminated. And so that was a huge dilemma that she had to encounter of, does she let these people, these children, be taken, or does she euthanize them herself? And it's certainly a heatedly debated topic, but for her, that was the decision that she made. And when you read the stories, you see how they treated the staff that they worked with like families. So many of them tried to take in other staff members when they lost their family members. They tried to comfort each other. I think understanding the people, the group of providers that they had and how they worked as a family is interesting. And I certainly think that we see that today in the modern world, how providers really look at each other as a family and as a group and the people to support. And I certainly saw that in this text. So the Kovno ghetto was another large ghetto, and that's a picture of it. So it had 29,000 Jews, and many of these Jews were forced into labor every day. It was a 10 square feet of living space for each individual person, which, as you know, is very small. So Dr. Elkanon Elks, he is fascinating. He was the head of the Judenrat for the Kovno ghetto. And he was a really extraordinary person. He regularly negotiated with Nazis to try and save Jewish and Gentile lives, which at the time was really, really fascinating. Gentiles who were caught trying to help Jews escape. And he went and argued on behalf of them, risking his life. And he consulted and appointed doctors, lawyers, and rabbis to help with the management and the administration of the ghetto. And he really tried to pull his resources that he had, the intellectual resources of not just how do we provide for the physical bodies of these people, but their spiritual lives as well. And when everything was turned over, how do you reinstate that in some sort of meaningful way for people who are living as prisoners? So that's a picture of the Judenrat. And these were all the individuals who were responsible for making decisions about the administration of the ghetto, particularly sanitation. Sanitation was really difficult. If you were caught, if you had lice, you were often exterminated immediately. So how do you find policies that are, do you use propaganda? Do you use punishment? How do you clean trash when you don't have anywhere to put trash? These are issues that still we see in the modern world. We see in resource poor areas. And I think it's really interesting to take a historical look into how these individuals dealt with these tremendously difficult situations and understand their modern implications. So Auschwitz was the largest concentration camp. This is a picture. Again, you can see lots of people crammed into small areas, inadequate food, inadequate shelter, inadequate clothing. And disease was rampant in these areas. You can imagine if somebody had lice in any of these barracks, how quickly that would travel. If somebody had typhus, how quickly that would travel throughout the entire barracks that people were housed in. So Auschwitz was an extremely large operation, Auschwitz 1, 2, and 3. It was both a concentration camp and an extermination camp. Approximately 1.1 million people were exterminated at this camp alone. 90% of them were Jewish. And it was liberated on January 27, 1945. Dr. Gisela Pearl was the camp gynecologist of Auschwitz, and she was selected as soon as she got off the train by Dr. Mengele, who was the head doctor of the Auschwitz camp. And while we generally think of gynecologists as providing care to women, what she mostly did was perform abortions, often late at night in the hospital ward, which was a completely concrete room. She had no tools. She had no antiseptic of any kind, and she performed abortions with her bare hands to these women late at night. And it was devastating to her. When you read her story, you really understand that she went into this to save babies and to bring them into the world. And it was devastating to her to think that what her role became in the camp and how she could minimize suffering was to provide abortions to these women. And for the few women who did give birth, she tried her best to have these children born late at night so that they wouldn't be found. And when they were unable to have the policies changed throughout Auschwitz, whether pregnancy was allowed or not allowed, again, with the mental torture that really went on with the victims and the prisoners here. And so oftentimes she would have to kill the babies when they were born, if they were safely born in Auschwitz, which was devastating for her. And her tale really talks about how she put herself on the line for these women. She would often stand next to them or in front of them if she could when they were at roll call to hide their pregnancies for as long as possible. And she talks about the women who she cared for before they were interned in a concentration camp and while they were in the concentration camp. One woman in particular was a lace maker, and she tried really hard to get pregnant. And when she did get pregnant, which was the last night before they were shipped away and she was separated from her husband, she went to Auschwitz, and Dr. Pearl had to kill her baby when she was born. So it was really, really devastating to see what healthcare providers have to do in situations and how they can provide comfort. Dr. Miklos Nitschi was a camp pathologist. He performed autopsies on those who died during Nazi research and sometimes who died of disease. So he was the pathologist who was responsible for writing the reports of twin studies in particular. Nazis were very infamous for their research of understanding twins because they wanted to figure out how they could increase Aryan births. So he was responsible for completely doing autopsies of these children. Also, for anybody who died of disease, if he often covered up and falsified records of people who died of things like typhus, because he knew that if typhus was the cause of death on the record, then that entire barracks would be liquidated or exterminated. So he really took that on himself as a pathologist, which was interesting because you don't generally think of pathologists in that direct care position. And to hear what he says about the twins and the dwarves and how he really had to be complicit, very much so, in this Nazi research was difficult for him. And while he did his best, he still had to provide information that led to the Nazi aims and goals. So I think the conclusions about this are really important. The idea that we need to understand that being a healthcare provider is a lot more than just being a healthcare provider. It's the compassion that's involved in it, and how do we provide for people when we don't have resources. And unfortunately, that is still the case for much of the world today, for people who go to resource-poor areas and try to provide that comfort and that compassion and to be with these people when they don't have anything else. And I think there are serious existential questions that we have to ask when we're understanding why do we go into this profession, why are we public health providers, and why are we clinicians? And I think traditionally public health has done a really great job of understanding that. And for me, it was important to understand that it also is with clinicians. Clinicians certainly have played a role in helping people when they don't have anything else. And recognizing that we have a lot of, recognizing that we have a long way to go, I think really to emphasize that when you don't have anything, that you can still be a healthcare provider, that you can still really help the souls of these individuals who don't have anything, that's really important. Thank you so much.